Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Business Movers ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today. It's Friday, April 26th, 1985, 3 days after the new Coke launch at PepsiCo headquarters in Purchase, New York. The office is mostly empty because Pepsi USA president Roger Enrico declared this day a company-wide holiday in celebration of Pepsi's victory over Coca-Cola. But Roger is still hard at work. He knows the war has really just begun. Over the next few weeks, Coca-Cola will roll out new Coke to consumers and try to make this new soft drink number one in the U.S. market. Roger wants to launch a series of commercials designed to attack new Coke and hopefully send Pepsi to the top. Roger huddles in his office with expert marketer Alan Potash, the creator of the Pepsi Generation campaign. Alan's already recorded one commercial set to air on Monday night, but both men agree they need to follow up quickly with a second spot.
Yeah, we need to hit him again, Roger. We need to hit him hard and fast.
Well, I agree completely, but with what?
Our approach is right. So is our message. They pulled old Coke because of us.
Well, exactly. We just need to come at it with a fresh angle. Any ideas?
Just then, a large man barrels through the door. It's Ron Tidmore, president of Pepsi's syrup division.
I've got it, boys.
Got what, Ron?
I know how to go after them.
Ron flashes a big smile.
Southerners.
Ron's an Alabama native who played football at the University of Georgia. Roger calls Ron Pepsi's resident Southerner.
We need to make a commercial for the good old boys who've been drinking Coke since they crawled out of the cradle.
All right, I like the sound of that. Go on.
It's like the local banker you've been going to see for years. You know the guy. Hell, you had him over for dinner. You know his kids, he knows yours. And then suddenly, out of nowhere, bam, you discover he's foreclosed on your family farm.
Roger's eyes light up as he starts to see Ron's vision.
Yeah, Alan, how fast can we get this on the air?
Well, I have to write it first.
How much time do you need?
Give me a couple of days. I'll turn it around.
I think this is it.
Time to deliver the knockout punch.
A few days later, Alan emerged with a script for a commercial called Wilbur.
What's the matter, Wilbur?
They changed my Coke.
Something wrong with it?
I know, but they sure changed it.
Coulda asked.
What coulda? I stuck with them through three wars and a couple of dust storms, but this is too much. Guess something big made them change.
Wilbur's friend pulls out an ice-cold can of Pepsi. Wilbur takes a sip and smiles with delight.
Right big. Pepsi, the choice of a new generation.
Still could have asked.
Coke was born in the American South, and for decades, Southerners were the bedrock of Coca-Cola's business. But many below the Mason-Dixon did not want new Coke. As one Mississippi professor told the Chicago Tribune in 1985, changing Coca-Cola is an intrusion on tradition, and a lot of Southerners won't like it, regardless of how it tastes. In the same story, an Alabama resident wondered, why'd they announce new Coke in New York? With the Wilbur ad, Roger Enrico was aiming for the heart of Coca-Cola's business. His commercial would fan the flames of outrage all across the South, and it would help take down new Coke and catapult Pepsi to number one.
Wow!
Nice!
Yeah!
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/Wondery. Code Wondery.
If you travel for work, you know to pack two suits, business and swim. You know with your Delta SkyMiles Business Amex card, buying that plane ticket for a business trip can get you closer to medallion status. You know that a meeting in Montana means visiting almost every national park.
Yellowstone? Check.
Because you're the chief excursion officer. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum Business American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/you-know-business.
From Wondery, I'm Lindsey Graham, and this is Business Movers. In his crusade against New Coke, Roger Enrico found plenty of allies in the media. On April 24, 1985, the day after New Coke's launch, Coca-Cola's hometown newspapers, the Atlanta Journal and the Atlanta Constitution, pitted Old Coke against New Coke in a head-to-head blind taste test. Old Coke won, hands down. The New York Times, the Washington Post, and the Chicago Tribune all picked up the story. When a Tribune columnist called Coca-Cola chairman Roberto Goizueta an arrogant and smug leader, Roberto fired off a letter attacking the columnist for typing when you should be tasting. Even in the face of increasingly bad press, Roberto remained confident that New Coke's superior taste would prevail in the end. Throughout the month of May, he stuck to the company line. New Coke couldn't fail. Once the customers tasted it, they would fall in love. But not all of them did. Roberto's fiercest critic would not be Roger Enrico or the media. It would be a lone Coca-Cola fan determined to turn the story of New Coke into a tale of David and Goliath. This is the final episode of our four-part series on Coca-Cola's greatest mistake, Strategic Retreat. It's May 1985 at a crowded restaurant in Seattle. Gay Mullins, a retired Seattle businessman, sits across a table from his good friend Frank Olson, who takes a freshly poured glass of New Coke from a friendly waitress.
Thank you, ma'am.
Mullins, though, watches with disgust as Frank drops his plastic straw into the ice-cold liquid.
I can't believe you're going to drink that garbage. Well, come on, it can't be that bad, right?
It is, trust me.
Well, how bad are we talking?
Bad, bad, like flat, soapy Pepsi.
Frank chuckles.
It's not funny, Frank. I'm pissed off.
Gay, it's just a soft drink.
No, no, it's not. This is Coke, Frank. This is America.
Okay. All right, pal.
I'm not kidding around. I feel betrayed, like a sacred trust has been violated. I bet I'm not alone either. I bet there are thousands of people out there who feel the exact same way. Hundreds of thousands, maybe millions.
Coca-Cola's made up their minds, Gay. New Coke is it. Nothing to be done about it.
Yes, there is.
And what's that?
Gay gets a determined look in his eyes.
Go after him.
Oh, yeah? And what are you going to do? Fly to Atlanta? Stand outside corporate headquarters with a sign? Give me my Coke back.
No.
I'm going to make a ruckus in the press so big they'll either bring Coke back or they'll pay the price.
Gay Mullins made good on his promise to go after Coca-Cola. Mullins and his friend Frank founded two corporations, Old Cola for America Incorporated and the Public Response Corporation. Frank worked in the background. Mullins was the public face. He created a 1-800 number and set up a call center at a Seattle hotel. Mullins also sold anti-New Coke t-shirts for $6 each. He hired lawyers, staged rallies and press events, and made a splash in the media. He told Newsweek, "Why am I putting my energies into this when people are starving in Ethiopia and dying in Central America? Somebody has to do it. You have to be ever vigilant in our democracy. When they took Old Coke off the market, they violated my freedom of choice. It's as basic as the Magna Carta and the Declaration of Independence. We went to war with Japan over that freedom." But Mullins' intentions were not entirely pure. Mullins funded his operation by borrowing over $100,000, and he fully expected the risk to be rewarded. Mullins believed that Coca-Cola would either give him a sponsorship deal or at the very least pay him and Frank enough money to go away. Behind the scenes, Mullins craved a payday. But in public, he wanted to look like an earnest consumer crusader. So Mullins agreed to take a series of blind taste tests administered by the Seattle Times. In one of them, Mullins couldn't tell Old Coke and New Coke apart. But that didn't stop the press from latching on to the David and Goliath angle. Gay Mullins, a Seattle retiree, versus the multi-billion dollar soda empire. And to help spread the story, Mullins gave countless interviews and made hundreds of appearances on radio and TV. Mullins would later describe himself as a general leading an army against Coca-Cola, saying, "It was exhilarating because what stuck in America's mind was that there was one individual who did it. And that gives everyone power. We were bigger news than President Reagan's tax plan." While Mullins led an assault on New Coke in Seattle, back in Atlanta, Roberto Goizueta struggled not only to overcome negative publicity, but also to even get New Coke on the shelves. His rollout schedule was ambitious. In just 5 weeks, Roberto planned to put New Coke in over 90% of the country.
The first stop in the rollout was Washington, D.C., where Coca-Cola set up a massive pop-up party just blocks away from the White House. In less than an hour, Coca-Cola representatives handed out 20,000 cans of new Coke to a mob of people. One of them was a young paralegal who drank 2 liters of old Coke a day. The man took his free sample of new Coke back to the office and shared it with a coworker. Both thought it was terrible. That night, the paralegal called his brother, another fan of old Coke, and told him about the terror that was new Coke. His brother panicked and went on a buying spree, purchasing 25 cases of old Coke in 3 weeks. The paralegal also was one of the tens of thousands of angry customers who called the Coca-Cola hotline in the weeks after the new Coke launch. He even wrote an angry letter to Roberto Goizueta and mailed copies to Coca-Cola's board to make sure Coca-Cola got the message. Helping amplify that message was Pepsi's Roger Enrico. After airing the Wilbur commercial appealing to Southerners, Roger's marketing team targeted an entirely different demographic with a second spot, making a direct appeal to young Coke drinkers.
Can somebody out there tell me why Coke did it? Why they changed? First, they said they were the real thing. Then they said they were it. Then kablooey, they changed.
The teenage girl takes a sip of Pepsi and smiles for the camera.
Now I know why.
Pepsi, the choice of a new generation.
In spite of the onslaught of bad publicity, New Coke wasn't a total failure, at least not according to Coca-Cola. It was underperforming in the South, but internal Coca-Cola surveys showed that a substantial portion of their customers had tried New Coke, enjoyed it, and planned to try it again. By the end of May, Coca-Cola was telling the press that New Coke had elevated their overall soft drink sales to an all-time high. Perhaps Sergio Zimán's New Coke marketing campaign was doing its job. Or perhaps Coca-Cola wasn't being honest about their numbers. Certainly Roger Enrico was skeptical. Roger's internal research showed that 80% of soft drink users thought New Coke was a bad idea, and 70% didn't like the taste. Roger believed Coca-Cola's efforts to label New Coke a success were nothing but smoke and mirrors. Pepsi's sales, on the other hand, were solid, and they were on the rise. So Roger wrote another letter and published it in newspapers all across the country. To all new Pepsi drinkers, welcome to the new Pepsi generation. In a nationwide survey, nearly half of those who have tried New Coke say it's time to switch to Pepsi. Our May sales were the highest for any month in our 87-year history, up a whopping 14% over last year. So thanks for your support, and welcome to the family. Roberto Goizueta could tolerate negative publicity, and he could stand combative letters from Roger Enrico. But when the Coca-Cola bottlers started complaining, Roberto knew the situation was dire. As one bottler put it, things were hitting the fan in the South. In the days after the launch, Don Keough fielded dozens of impassioned calls from Southern bottlers. One Alabama bottler told Don New Coke was a disaster, saying, "My God, this is costing us a lot of money." In the reliable Coke stronghold of Rome, Georgia, one bottler reported back that store owners were refusing to put New Coke on the shelves and sending the product back to the factory. Initially, Coca-Cola's U.S. bottlers had been thrilled at the prospect of a new Coke. A new Coca-Cola product meant bigger sales and more profits. But just days after the new Coke launch, the bottlers were tired of the angry phone calls and nasty letters. When he first took the reins as CEO, Roberto had promised to always listen to the bottlers, men he saw as the heart and soul of the Coca-Cola company. So when the bottlers pushed back against new Coke, Roberto took it seriously. He ordered his researchers to conduct more consumer tests. Roberto and Don presented the results to the bottlers at a late May meeting in Atlanta. Roberto's research showed that in blind taste tests, customers still preferred the taste of New Coke by a margin of 3%. But Roberto's data didn't square with the vitriol the bottlers were enduring on the ground, especially in the South. Taste didn't matter. Consumers were rejecting the idea of New Coke. The bottlers begged Roberto and Don to bring back the old formula. But the two leaders remained calm and projected confidence in New Coke. One bottler would later write, "Roberto and Don were putting on a hell of an act, but it was obvious to me that they knew the jig was up." It was true. By the end of May, Roberto was losing faith in New Coke, and so was Don Keough.
Around that time, Don overheard a bar conversation between two men. One man admitted to the other that he had tried New Coke and liked it, but he'd be damned if he let Coca-Cola know it. Still, Sergio Zimon and his boss Brian Dyson were not ready to give up on New Coke. They remained confident that New Coke's superior taste would eventually lift the controversial soft drink to number one. Thanks to their confidence, Roberto and Don kept any doubts to themselves. But as spring turned into summer, the negative publicity didn't slow down, and neither did the customer revolt. Soon, the Coca-Cola call center was getting as many as 5,000 negative calls a day. They received over 40,000 letters and nearly 600 petitions signed by a total of almost 30,000 disgruntled customers. In face of this resistance, Roberto, Don, Sergio, and Dyson were forced to confront reality and consider the possibility of surrender.
If you travel, you know how to pull off a perfect getaway. You know, after you enroll with your Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card, you get up to $10 back monthly on U.S. rideshare purchases with select providers, like a car to the airport. You know which remote retreats have the best herbal baths and where the Wi-Fi password is rarely used. Because you're the escape artist. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Purchases must be on card. Visit go.amex/you know.
If you're shopping while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast, then you know and love the thrill of the hunt. But are you getting the thrill of the best deals? Rakuten shoppers do. They get the brands they love with the most savings and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores, like Urban Outfitters, Fenty Beauty, and Expedia. And even stack sales on top of cash back. It's easy to use, and you get your cash back through PayPal or check. The idea is simple. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back. Download the free Rakuten app and never miss a deal. Or go to Rakuten.com to start getting the most bang for your buck. That's Rakuten.
It's the summer of 1985 at a Coca-Cola call center in downtown Atlanta. Sergio Zimon stands in the middle of the room looking out over a sea of phone operators. The negative response to New Coke is keeping Sergio up at night. He hasn't slept more than 3 hours a night in weeks, and it's showing. Mr. Zimon, Mr. Nunley, well, welcome to the Blob. The Blob? Yeah, that's what we call the place. Come on, let's talk in my office. Roger Nunley, Coca-Cola's manager of consumer affairs, sits at his desk as Sergio stands by the window looking out onto the crowded floor. Can I get you anything, Mr. Zimon? Coffee? New Coke? No, I'm fine. But why do you call it the Blob? Because it gets bigger every day. You know, when we started the hotline back in 83, there were 3 employees, 1 temp and 7 phone lines. Today I have... Nunley grabs a file off his desk and opens it. 20 staff members, 27 temps, and 83 phone lines. 83? Yeah, and frankly, it's not enough. I brought back a dozen people out of retirement. I even hired nearly 70 college students. I've got over 150 people working for me now, and I'm still stretched thin. How can that be? Well, we're getting over 8,000 calls a day now. Surely you know this. And it's not just Coke drinkers who are upset. Well, what do you mean? Some of these people drink Diet Coke. They drink Dr. Pepper, they drink Tab, but they're furious. I don't understand. Why would a non-Coke drinker be furious about New Coke? That's the principle of the thing. You don't mess with Coke. Sergio narrows his eyes. Nunley holds his hands up. Hey, look, don't shoot the messenger. If you want my 2 cents, this doesn't have anything to do with taste. Just last week, this lady called. She's smart as a whip. She's one of the nicer ones, believe me. But she wants her old Coke back. My phone operator, college kid, explains in no uncertain terms that in a taste test, New Coke wins every time. But the old lady doesn't care. You know what she says? Young man, I hate coffee, but I drink it every day. Sergio sighs, defeated. He feels personally responsible for the chaos in the operator's pit. Nunley can sense Sergio's wrestling with the moment. Mr. Zimon, maybe you ought to spend some time with the operators. Take a few calls yourself. You might find it educational. All right? You know, when can I start? Sergio was always an advocate of the hotline. Some of his colleagues felt it was an invitation to criticism. But Sergio wanted to know what his customers were thinking and feeling. And he was confident he could manage any complaint. But he had no idea just how intense the blowback would be. Throughout the summer of 1985, Sergio personally monitored the hotline and he witnessed the vitriol firsthand. Sergio discovered that even some of the phone operators were angry about New Coke. He had put his heart and soul into Project Kansas, but by June of 1985, just 2 months after the New Coke launch, Sergio was ready to wave the white flag. And so was Roberto Goizueta's right-hand man, Don Keough. Don stayed in constant communication with Coca-Cola's bottlers, and their verdict was nearly unanimous. They wanted Old Coke back. It wasn't about taste, and in some parts of the country, it wasn't even about sales. As Don would later say, "My own view is that sales volume had nothing to do with it. There were pockets of problems, particularly in the South, but the public outcry was too big, too constant, and too real." So in late June, Don told Sergio Zimon and his boss, Brian Dyson, that they needed to come up with a plan of action, and fast. Dyson put three options on the table. Wait until the end of summer to decide. Stay the course with New Coke. Or pull New Coke from the shelves and bring Old Coke back. Don scheduled a lunch with Roberto Goizueta in Coca-Cola Tower to discuss moving forward. After staring each other down throughout the meal, Don finally asked Roberto, "Why are we doing this?" And Roberto didn't have a good answer. But Roberto did not want to surrender. So instead, he chose a fourth option, a strategic retreat. Roberto decided to bring back Old Coke to soothe his customers' anger. But he would keep New Coke on the shelves to give it a fighting chance. On July 7th, Coca-Cola's PR team met in New York and started creating a plan to reintroduce Old Coke, or as Roberto decided to call it, Coke Classic. The marketing team wrote a script for a commercial and hired an actor to read the copy, but the message just wasn't landing. So the team asked Don Keough to step in. Don nailed it on the fourth take.
"I'm Don Keough, president of the Coca-Cola Company. When we brought you the new taste of Coke, we knew that millions would prefer it, and millions do. And we knew that it would beat the taste of our major competitor, and it does. What we didn't know was how many thousands of you would phone and write asking us to bring back the classic taste of original Coca-Cola. Well, we read and we listened, and you know the rest. They're both yours, the new taste of Coke and Coca-Cola Classic. Your right of choice is back."
Coca-Cola's PR team rushed the video to the major news networks. ABC anchor Peter Jennings interrupted the scheduled programming to break the news.
"General Hospital will continue in a moment.
An ABC News brief brought to you by Apple Computer. Now from Los Angeles, here's Peter Jennings.
The old taste of Coca-Cola is coming back. Within the next several weeks, the original taste, which many people in the country apparently missed, will be available again. It will be called Coca-Cola Classic. Ah, the Cola Wars. That's News Brief. I'm Peter Jennings."
After Jennings broke the story, Roger Nunley's team in the Coca-Cola call center fielded over 12,000 phone calls from elated customers, praising the company for doing the right thing. The next morning, on July 11th, 1985, Coke Classic was front page news. That afternoon, hundreds of reporters from all over the country gathered in a small auditorium at Coca-Cola headquarters to hear from Roberto Goizueta himself. Roberto told them, "Today we have two messages to deliver to the American consumer. First, to those of you who are drinking New Coke with its great new taste, our thanks. But there's a second group of consumers to whom we want to speak to today, and our message to this group is simple. We have heard you." Don Keough addressed the crowd as well. There were many in the audience who saw the Coke Classic announcement as a consumer victory over a mega corporation. To those critics, Don said, "I love that. We love any victory of the public, which proves so conclusively that this company does listen, does read its mail, does care with all its heart for its consumers. Our boss is the consumer." After his speech, Don told the press that the experience had been humbling, but that it was nice to be loved again. The day of the press event, the Coca-Cola call center received even more happy phone calls, 18,000. The flood of excitement even had some skeptics wondering if New Coke was not a failure at all, but a rather brilliant marketing scheme designed to sell more original Coke. At the press conference, Don Keough addressed that idea directly.
"Some critics will say Coca-Cola has made a marketing mistake. And some cynics say that we planned the whole thing. The truth is, we're not that dumb, and we're not that smart.
The day after the press conference, Don Keough got a call from Gay Mullins, the public face of the anti-New Coke movement. On the phone, Don conceded defeat, telling Mullins, "You won." But Mullins wasn't calling to gloat. Mullins wanted Coca-Cola to pay him $200,000 for a sponsorship deal. When Coca-Cola politely declined, Mullins was furious. He briefly joined forces with the National Sugar Association and attacked Coke Classic in the press, calling it an imposter. Mullins claimed Coke Classic was not the real thing because it used high fructose corn syrup and not cane sugar. What Mullins didn't know was that Roberto Goizueta had switched to high fructose corn syrup 5 years earlier, long before the launch of New Coke. In the end, Gay Mullins' shakedown backfired. He had borrowed over $100,000 to finance his quest to take down New Coke. But in 1985, his companies earned a grand total of only $1,400, not even enough to pay for the t-shirts. In the end, Mullins came out looking like a loser. But PepsiCo's Roger Enrico emerged from the New Coke story looking like the new king of cola. By the middle of the summer, Pepsi sales were skyrocketing. One excited Pepsi bottler told Roger, "I've never sold so much Pepsi in my life." Before the announcement of the return of Coke Classic, Roger had briefly considered co-opting Coca-Cola's original formula and rolling out a new Pepsi product called Savanna Classic Cola. He figured if Coca-Cola didn't want to profit off the old recipe, Roger would be happy to. When he floated the idea by his board of directors, they were all in. But after the news that Coke Classic would mark the return of the original formula, Roger decided to quit while he was ahead. Though he would later say he regretted the decision, Roger abandoned Savanna Classic Cola, in part because he didn't think he needed it. Roger's data showed that Pepsi would end 1985 as the number one soft drink in the United States market. Victory was at hand. But Roberto Goizueta had no intention of giving up first place. After his strategic retreat, Roberto was determined to regroup and re-enter the fight. Roberto, the chemical engineer, was a numbers man, and in Coca-Cola's reams of market and sales reports, Roberto saw opportunity in adversity. After introducing Coke Classic, Roberto would use data and Coca-Cola's massive marketing machine to seize the moment, reframe the conversation, and snatch victory from the jaws of defeat.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. FedEx offers fast delivery, more visibility, simple returns, and weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. population on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. With FedEx, you get picture proof of delivery, ensuring you always know where your package is. Returns are simple with packageless and paperless returns. Plus, FedEx Ground is also faster to more locations than UPS Ground. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. So, what are you waiting for? See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively, FedEx.
It's summer 1985 in Roberto Goizueta's plush office at Coca-Cola headquarters. Roberto sits at his desk across from a securities analyst from a powerful Wall Street firm. Roberto wants to be sure the analyst leaves the meeting confident enough that he'll report back to Wall Street that Coca-Cola stock is a strong buy. But the analyst's first question catches Roberto off guard. "Mr. Goizueta, you've been at the helm of this company for half a decade. What do you consider your greatest achievement?" Roberto is the type of man who looks forward, not back. But the analyst's question sparks a flood of memories. Roberto answers by asking a question of his own. "Do you know why I left my father's sugar business?" "No, I don't believe I do." "Well, there was so much regulation in Cuba. My father nearly drowned in it. He did well, but he had to fight for what he built every step of the way. I wanted something different. And when I saw that Help Wanted ad for Coca-Cola in the newspaper, I didn't think twice. My father supported my decision. But he told me you shouldn't work for someone else. You should work for yourself. So after I got the job, he lent me the money to buy 100 shares of Coca-Cola stock. Do you know what those shares are worth today? Probably a lot." "Yes, a lot. I came to this country to build a life and a career, and I've built a fine one.
But the thing I'm most proud of is that in the summer of 1969, I became a citizen here in the greatest country in the world. Okay? Well, what do you consider your greatest failure? Well, I'll leave that to the history books. Surely New Coke is on the list. New products are often misunderstood. But in the end, the numbers tell the full story. And the numbers don't lie. Oh, Mr. Goizueta, come on. If you knew in April what you know now, would you still launch New Coke? Roberto smirks. Well, what do I know now? I'm curious to hear your opinion. You know, the letters, the angry phone calls, the public outcry. Everyone has an opinion. Pepsi certainly does. Roger Enrico says you lost the cola wars. Mr. Enrico is entitled to his opinion, but I respectfully disagree. Okay. But you say numbers don't lie. Well, it looks like Pepsi will finish the year number one in the U.S. soft drink market. So what do you have to say to that? I say that you're not seeing the bigger picture. Okay. Tell me what I'm missing then. You can't just put Coke Classic or New Coke up against Pepsi or any other soft drink for that matter. That sort of comparison makes for good headlines, but it doesn't tell the whole story of this company. You have to look at the total corporate share of the total industry and all the component parts that make it up. You're talking about, what do you call it again, mega brand? Precisely. At the end of 1985, you mark my words, Coca-Cola's mega brand, our total corporate share of all of our Coke-branded products, will be number one. Your sudden emphasis on mega brand, it's a convenient way of analyzing the data, and a bit of a reversal from some of your previous statements about the importance of U.S. market share. Well, in that case, I have another prediction for you. Coke Classic will surpass Pepsi in U.S. market share. You just wait and see. And what about your shareholders? Are they as confident as you? I'm not here to make shareholders comfortable or confident. I'm here to make them rich. Trust me, they're going to be happy. It's like I said before, the numbers don't lie. Pepsi had declared victory in the cola wars. But looking at total market share across all soft drink products, Coca-Cola was still king. In 1985, Coca-Cola's mega brand, its total corporate share, owned almost 38% of the soft drink market. PepsiCo owned 31%. But Coca-Cola's mega brand dominance was not a result of New Coke or even Coke Classic. It was a result of multiple extensions of the Coke brand: Diet Coke, caffeine-free Diet Coke, caffeine-free Coke, Cherry Coke, and Diet Cherry Coke. And despite Roberto's attempts to reframe the conversation, Roger Enrico did win bragging rights over the U.S. market. By the end of 1985, Pepsi was the number one U.S. soft drink, capturing 19.5% of the U.S. market. Coke Classic lagged behind at 14%. As a result, the New Coke saga left many in the media scratching their heads. Some journalists suggested that New Coke happened because Roberto Goizueta was an outsider who didn't understand American culture and therefore did not know what he was tampering with. One Alabama columnist wrote, "I've had an uneasy feeling ever since a fellow by the name of Roberto Goizueta was named chairman and chief executive officer of the Coca-Cola Company of Atlanta, Georgia, U.S. of A. Roberto Goizueta, if memory serves me correctly, is from Havana, Cuba." Imagine that. Coca-Cola historian Thomas Oliver argued that the pushback to New Coke in the South was never about taste or even about brand loyalty, but rather wounds from American history that never healed. Oliver wrote, "It was an extension of the Civil War. Here was Coca-Cola, a Southern company, laying down its arms in deference to its Yankee counterpart. Coke, the quintessential Southern drink, was changing its image and content to conform with the rival Pepsi in the North." But whatever the underlying reason, many Americans were simply grateful that Roberto and Don reversed course and introduced Coke Classic. By the end of 1985, the Coca-Cola call center had received nearly 500,000 letters and phone calls from fans expressing their appreciation. One mother wrote to say thank you and to let Coca-Cola know that her baby's first word was Coke. Eventually, the New Coke Brain Trust, Sergio, Dyson, Don, and Roberto, all admitted that Pepsi was the real reason they changed the formula, and Roger Enrico was especially pleased with that. Still, Roberto Goizueta stood by his decision. In November of 1985, Roberto laid out three hypothetical scenarios Coca-Cola might have encountered with New Coke. One, they might have announced New Coke and no one would have cared. 2, they might have perfectly predicted the severity of the backlash, in which case Roberto said he still would have announced New Coke, but he would have brought out Coke Classic sooner. Or 3, Coca-Cola might have made an imperfect forecast, which is what ended up happening. As Roberto explained, we knew we were going to have disgruntled customers, but we didn't know there would be that many. In all 3 scenarios, Roberto maintained we would still be in the same position today. Roberto would keep New Coke on the shelves until 1992, when the company renamed it Coke 2. Coke 2 would carry on until it was discontinued in July of 2002 due to declining sales. Roberto was wrong about many aspects of the New Coke launch. He miscalculated how strong the backlash would be. He was perhaps too coy with the press about why he changed the formula. And he assumed that taste mattered more than brand loyalty. But as Roberto once told a securities analyst, "I do not get paid to be right. I get paid to produce results." After the rollout of Coke Classic, Coca-Cola's stock soared. By the summer of 1986, the stock jumped from a low of 66 a share to 113. And in addition to his already hefty salary and bonus structure, the board rewarded Roberto with stock performance compensation worth more than $5 million. Don Keough received a package worth $3 million. In 1986, Brian Dyson left his job as president of Coca-Cola USA to become CEO of one of the company's biggest bottling operations, Coca-Cola Enterprises. That same year, Sergio Zimán resigned to start his own consulting firm called the Zimán Group, which would sell in 2005 for roughly $60 million. A year after the introduction of New Coke, in the summer of 1986, Coca-Cola commemorated its 100-year anniversary by hosting a week-long centennial celebration in Atlanta. Nearly 25,000 guests came from all 50 states and over 120 foreign countries. Coca-Cola had plenty of reason to celebrate, even beyond the anniversary. That year, Coke Classic stole back the crown from Pepsi, reclaiming its place as the number one soft drink in the U.S. market by the slim margin of 0.4%. And as of the end of 2020, Coke Classic remains the top soft drink in the U.S. market and the most popular soft drink in the world. Roberto Goizueta is widely considered one of the most influential CEOs in American history. During his 16 years at the helm of Coca-Cola, Roberto grew the total value of the company stock from $4.3 billion to more than $152 billion. And under Roberto's leadership, Coca-Cola became one of the most recognized brands on the planet. Roberto's success was in large part a result of his willingness to take intelligent risks. Some of those risks, like New Coke, didn't go exactly as planned. But as Roberto once observed, if you take risks, you may fail. But if you don't take risks, you will surely fail. The greatest risk of all is to do nothing. On the next episode of Business Movers, we'll wrap up our series on Coca-Cola's greatest mistake with an interview with Tim Murphy, senior reporter at Mother Jones and author of the article, "New Coke Didn't Fail, It Was Murdered." Hey, Prime members. You can listen to Business Movers ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey. From Wondery, this is episode 4 of Coca-Cola's Greatest Mistake for Business Movers. A quick note about our reenactments. In most cases, we can't know exactly what was said, but all our dramatizations are based on historical research. If you'd like to learn more about New Coke, we recommend The Other Guy Blinked, How Pepsi Won the Cola Wars by Roger Enrico and Jesse Kornbluth, The Real Coke, The Real Story by Thomas Oliver, and For God, Country, and Coca-Cola by Mark Pendergrast. Business Movers is hosted, edited, and executive produced by me, Lindsey Graham, for Airship. Audio editing by Molly Bogg. Sound design by Derek Behrens. Music by Lindsey Graham. This episode is written and researched by Stephen Walters. Edited by Leah Waters. Executive producers are Stephen Walters for Ritual Productions and Jenny Lauer Beckman and Marshall Louis for Wondery.
Once upon a beat.
Remember the
stories and fables that captured your imagination when you were young, we have a perfect podcast to bring you the stories you remember, remixed and reimagined for the kids in your life today. Yeah. Wondery and Tinkercast are bringing you a music-filled weekly party hosted by me, DJ Fuse, and my trusty turntable, Baby Scratch, spinning tales in the New Kids and Family podcast, Once Upon a Beat, where hip-hop and fables meet. Hey, grown-ups, listen to Once Upon a Beat early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus.
Once Upon a Beat.